Right. Thank you very much. This topic, I think, is going to be really different from all the other talks that that I've listened to this week, because there's no renormalization in this, and I'm studying really the infinitesimal picture of the KPZ in a sense. And this is mostly about the ergodic theory of the Bruegger situation, and somehow there is also a dynamical system flavor in the material that I'm going to talk about. So in ergodic theory, one of the main topics is describing ergodicity and explaining what stationary regimes of deterministic or stochastic systems look like. And in general, ergodicity means that long-term statistical properties of solutions do not depend on the initial condition. But in general, the question can be formulated more broadly, and in general, you can ask the following. You can ask, what do the long-term statistical properties of the system, what do they depend on? And in general, the answer is that there may be multiple ergodic components of the system, and you have ergodicity on each of them. So this is the general picture that I will talk about in this talk with applications to Bruegger's equation. Now, everything in this talk will be based on the so-called one force, one solution principle. And this is a very important idea in random dynamical systems. That's why I decided to give two slides about one force, one solution principle in an extremely simple situation that has nothing to do with PDEs even. So let me... So this is the plan. I'll just give you one toy example where one force, one solution applies. Then I will say generalities about the Bruegger's equation. Then I will explain basics about the existing work on the Bruegger's equation with random forcing in the compact case. And then I'll switch to more recent developments, which is non-compact case for zero viscosity Bruegger's equation. And the really new stuff is this. So I hope I'll have time to talk about that. Okay, so one force, one solution for a toy model. So this is an extremely simple Markov process. So imagine that you have a sequence of random maps of the following form. Everything is on the real line. So first you apply a linear contraction. You multiply the current value x by small number a, so that brings you closer to the origin. And then you add a random variable. Let's say you add a Gaussian random variable. So the resulting process is sort of Ornstein-Uhlenbeck type. And of course, everything is extremely clear about the system, but there is one point that I want to stress. So you have this contraction, and then perturbation by noise. And if not for the noise, then the contraction would have brought you to the origin very well, exponentially fast. So this is a very dissipative system. But there is this balance between the contraction and the noisy perturbation that gives rise to stationary regime for this equation, of course, which is Gaussian. But it is useful to look at the system not simply as a Markov process, but from the point, but pathwise, so using the dynamical system approach. Sorry. So this is what the iteration of this random map looks like, right? So first you apply this map corresponding to time m plus 1, then m plus 2, and so on. You get to the m, so you have applied n minus m different random maps. And the result of this evolution is very simple. I mean, this is the expression that you get. And now if you want to study the long-term properties of this system, I mean, typically we think that when we say long-term, it means that we send this time n to plus infinity. But it turns out, and this is a basic fundamental idea in random dynamical systems, that it is often more useful to send the starting time m to minus infinity instead. So that's sort of, in a sense, you switch to the point of view where you treat this n as plus infinity already. So you want to say at this given time n, you want to see the result of the evolution from the infinite past. So what is the result of the evolution from the infinite past? What kind of values can you get? In this elementary case, the situation is of course very very clear. As m goes to minus infinity, you simply get more and more terms in this expansion, and the contribution from the x it goes to zero. So of course it's clear that this means that the situation is ergodic because the dependence on the initial condition vanishes in the end. So the long-term properties of this evolution doesn't depend on the starting condition on the initial point at all. But what's more important is that as m goes to minus infinity, you get almost sure convergence to a series, right? So if you suppose you were sending n to plus infinity, then you would have got only convergence in distribution, which is also nice. But here you get almost sure convergence, okay, and to a totally well-defined value. So this is what I just said. It's written in symbols, right? So you have convergence to this series, and I denote this capital X. It's random. It depends on n. And there are several facts about this process that altogether can be called one force one solution principle. So first of all, an obvious fact that thus obtained process X, it is actually global solution. It satisfies. It is invariant under this map, right? So if you apply the random map corresponding to time n to the previous value, then you get x n from the next value. So you get this trajectory x that is global in time. So you get a global solution. It's really a solution because it satisfies this. The solution is a functional of the history of the forcing, right? So I treat these random inputs as I call them forcing because that's what is going to be in the fluid dynamic case, right? So it's totally clear that this xn depends on randomness only through the past. It's a stationary process because it's just a functional stationary process. So it becomes a stationary process. And also you can easily prove that this is a unique global solution that is a stationary process. Of course, you can take any point and you can iterate it forward and backward using the linear equation, but then for a typical point, if you iterate backward, you will not get a stationary, so it will blow up. But this special one, this special red one, is a global solution that is stationary. And it's unique. It's a unique process that satisfies all these properties. And of course, you can also, by computing the distribution of this process xn, which is very easy to do, all these are Gaussians with decaying coefficients. By computing the distribution of this, you're computing the unique invariant distribution for the Markov process. So there are two points of view. One is that you have just the Markov process where you sort of only observe the distributions of your process xn, but the dynamical system point of view really tracks the paths. So summarizing all this, you can say that the only global solution that is a stationary process x, it is given by a functional of the past. So there is a unique value at present that corresponds to the noisy inputs in the past, and that justifies the term one force one solution with probability 1 to 1 sequence of random inputs in the past. You can assign a unique value at xn. So this is a very simple picture for this case, and now my goal is to tell the same story for stochastic PDEs. Why do we have this picture? It's because this concrete system has a lot of contraction, right? I contract every time I multiply by this factor of a, and so there is a hope that if you have dissipative systems with a lot of contraction, that you can recover the same stuff even in infinite dimensional dynamical systems. It's not always true, because in systems with expansions, instead of obtaining a random delta measure, right, so you have the history of the force, you're assigning a delta measure, a random delta measure at present. In principle, you can have more complicated so-called sample measures, but in this talk I will talk only about this one force, one solution situation. Okay, so now to the Burgers equation. So this is what it is.
One naive question. I mean, if you have this one solution, I mean naturally, I mean that contains all the information about the long time behavior of your original system. I mean that's sort of
Yes, of course. Right. I mean you can treat this solution as you can call it a one point pullback random attractor. But also it serves as a forward attractor, because this solution actually also converges to it. I mean, you can study various things using this. It's a useful representation. Okay, so this is the Burgers equation in one dimension. I will be talking only about 1D today. It is the spatial derivative of the KPZ equation. But there are various ways to interpret this equation, and I like the fluid dynamic interpretation, where u stands for the velocity of the particle located at point t at time t at point x. So you should imagine that the entire real line is filled with particles. Each particle is moving, and its velocity at time t. Velocity of the particle that's located at time t at point x is denoted by u, and it's connected to all kinds of useful and nice things. Now, why does it have to do anything with hydrodynamics? It was actually introduced by Burgers as a simplified model of turbulence. And although there are some turbulent features in this equation, generally it is now thought that this is not a very good model of turbulence, because you have too much contraction as opposed to the real Navier-Stokes system. But anyway, if you want to see the hydrodynamic nature of this, this easy computation shows that the left-hand side computes the acceleration of the particle that's located at time t at point x. And then on the right-hand side, you're supposed to have forces acting on the particle, and so there is a friction term with this viscosity, and there is external forcing. And in principle, in this talk, I'm interested mostly in studying the long-term behavior of this equation when the forcing is random. Right. So if the viscosity nu is zero. Then it means that there's no this friction term. It means that particles do not interact with each other until they really hit each other. So the zero viscosity case corresponds to the situation of this is called sticky dust. So these dust particles do not interact until they bump into each other and then form shock waves. Now, if the viscosity is positive, then the velocity profile is smoothened by that Laplacian term. Why is there a hope to have stationary solutions to this? Well, it's because there is balance, there's a certain energy balance. The energy is pumped in by the external forcing, so you use the external forcing to accelerate particles, but then the energy is dissipated due to friction in the positive viscosity case, and that shocks at zero viscosity case. So when viscosity is positive, you can solve this equation using the Hopf-Cole substitution and Feynman-Kast formula. So capital U is supposed to solve the Hamilton-Jacobi equation or KPZ equation, and then you introduce the new variable V, and through this logarithmic transformation, and then V solves a linear heat equation with multiplicative potential, and so you can write the Feynman-Kast formula, and it looks like this, right? So of course, everybody knows what this is. You to find the solution at point x, you have to emit Wiener processes backwards in time and integrate over all these paths and find, for each path, find the potential accumulated through the path and also the contribution from zero. And actually, as viscosity goes to zero, you can use large deviation principle in this formula. So as nu goes to zero, you can obtain this limiting expression, and this is the variational principle for the zero viscosity equation. So I mean, from the large deviation principle point of view, I mean this is the rate function for the Wiener process, in fact. And so all these terms they are present in some form in the Feynman-Katz formula. So this is called Lax-Alenik variational principle. That's LO in that abbreviation. The other letters are Hamilton, Jacobi, Bellman. And so this says that if you want to find the solution of the inviscid Bürger's equation, or actually the integrated version for the capital U, you have to consider all curves that start at time zero and they end at time t point x. And for each curve, you have to compute this action. And there are three terms. One is something that's picked up by the curve at time zero, then the kinetic energy, and then the potential energy. And it turns out that for reasonable initial conditions, for reasonable forcing, there is typically there is a unique minimizer. There is a unique curve gamma that gives you the minimum in this formula. And then after you have solved all these variational problems for each point Tx, you will have a family of all these minimizers, and then to find the solution of the Bürger's equation, the small u, of course you can use just the definition that small u is the derivative of capital U, but also you can, it turns out you can compute small u as the velocity of this minimizer at the terminal point, and that corresponds to the fact that the minimizer can be identified with a particle trajectory. So a priori we don't know which particle is going to land there, right? So you have all these particles on the real line, they start moving and they get accelerated by the external vector field. So which one is going to arrive to this point? A priori you don't know, but it turns out that that's the solution of this variational problem. And for some points you will have more than one solution. So you might have this two optimal trajectories, and then this means that you will have a shock. So there will be two particles, each bringing its own velocity. So from the right will be some velocity, from the left there will be another velocity. So there will be a jump in the velocity. So these are so this is the background on the Bürger's equation. So we know how to solve the inviscid equation. We know how to solve the viscous Bürger's equation. So now let me talk about the randomness. So I'm going to study the situation where the external forcing F, external potential of the forcing, is random. And I want to understand the long-term properties of solution. I want to describe invariant distributions. And I want to see the one force, one solution principle. So the first a very influential paper by these four authors. It studied the situation where the first of all, everything in this paper is on the circle, right? So all my pictures were on the real line, but in fact, now assume that everything is periodic in space. And what they did was they studied the external potential that is white in time and smooth in space. And for this potential, these authors described all the ergodic components for this system. One remark is that the integral, the average of the velocity, is always conserved by the Bürger's equation. And so, if you ask what is remembered about the initial condition, then of course this quantity is always remembered. If you start with some c, then it will be there forever. But it turns out, and that's what they proved, that that's the only quantity that is preserved, that is remembered. happen. So if you fix C, then on each such a set, the random dynamics is ergodic. So there is unique invariant distribution for the Markov process, on each described by the Burgess equation with this potential on each of those sets. And moreover, they prove one force one solution principle on each such component. I mean, they prove more things, but this is what's important for my today's story. So what does one force one solution principle look like in that situation? Well, so you have to do this pullback procedure, right? So you, instead of pushing time to plus infinity, you have to push to assign initial condition in long distant past, and then see what the effect is going to be. So this is long distant past, or this long distant past, and you want to understand what is the limiting, what kind of outcome you're going to see at a fixed time t. So for each time t, you fix you solve a finite operational problems, right? So between time minus t and t, you find all these minimizers, and then you let this time minus t go into minus infinity, and you keep constructing all these minimizers. And what they proved was that the minimizers in the variational principle, they converge to a limiting family of one-sided minimizers. So these one-sided minimizers, they sort of go from each of those points here back to the past, to infinite past, and you have convergence of finite time horizon minimizers to these infinite time horizons that can be treated. I mean, I call them minimizers. Now, of course, the action of an infinite trajectory is infinite, but they're like ground states, right? So local perturbations cannot improve the action. And now, from the slopes of all these minimizers, of course, I can read off the velocity profile at any given time, and in particular, from these terminal slopes of these infinite minimizers, I can read off the velocity profile, which turns out that there is a unique velocity profile that's compatible with the history of the forcing, and it just coincides with the slopes of all these infinite minimizers. So the story on the cylinder is true if you fix the average velocity to be equal to zero. If it's not equal to zero, it's the same story, but you have to work on the universal cover. So interestingly, in this procedure, if you take two different initial conditions that both average to zero, the result of this procedure doesn't depend on these details. And that's sort of due to the fact that what's more important for these minimizers is the action that they acquire in there while they travel through space-time, and what you can acquire from the initial condition becomes less and less important as that goes to minus infinity. So otherwise, you have one force one solution principle. You have the velocity profile is at time t is just a function of the forcing in the past from the distribution of this unique solution. You can read off that's the unique stationary distribution for the Markov process, for the corresponding Markov process. These minimizers possess the so-called hyperbolicity property. Hyperbolicity in dynamical systems means often forward the exponential divergence of trajectories, but it turns out that these minimizers converge to each other exponentially fast. And in particular, this allows to compare the infinite actions of two different minimizers to each other, right? Because remember, I'm solving actually the Hamilton-Jacobi equation, which is the integrated Burgess equation, and there you have to, and the solution is given by actions over these paths, and since they are close to each other in infinite past, then by adding more and more, by expanding the time horizon, you are adding only little increment to the discrepancy in the action. So the result is that the difference in action between this and that, although they are infinite, is well defined. And this difference can be called the Guzman function. And I think in the original work it was not really studied, it wasn't called this Guzman function, but implicitly it's there. Now the entire picture holds true because these minimizers, they're relatively tame. So the compact nature of this, of the phase, I mean, you're on the cylinder, so these particles cannot really accelerate too much. They cannot have arbitrarily large velocities. And so together with the rigidity of the two-dimensional geometry, I mean, minimize these particles cannot really go through each other. So that gives you answers to many things. I mean, you can choose converging subsequences, you can prove uniqueness essentially due to rigidity. I mean, it's a more complicated story, but that's all I can. I spoke too long.
Screensaver?
I'm not sure what's going on. Sorry. So other results in the compact setting are listed here. So you can do similar stuff in the multidimensional torus instead of the circle. You can do things on a segment with random boundary conditions. So simplified proof of hyperbolicity appeared recently. There are some PDE methods, PDE-based, I mean, papers that are using more PDE methods. And there were several attempts to treat mildly non-compact setting where you are on the entire real line, but you mostly stir your particles in the middle. But a lot of progress was achieved in two more recent papers. So we can actually repeat the ergodic program in the truly non-compact case. For two models. So the difficulty in the non-compact case is that you don't have good bounds a priori, you don't have good bounds on the velocities of those minimizers. And as the time horizon grows, potentially they can become really wild, these optimal trajectories. But it turns out that for a couple of models that I'm going to briefly talk about, you can prove that doesn't happen. So this is the first model. It's joint work with Eric Kator and Kostya Hanin. And in this paper, we assume that the external potential is of Poissonian type. So it means that instead of white noise in the previous papers, we considered the forcing that was concentrated in space-time Poissonian points. And well, it simply means that in the action, I keep the two terms, the kinetic action contribution from the initial condition, but I replace the potential with this minus number of Poissonian points visited by the path. I mean, in large, the situation is this: you have these two contributions, and you have some randomness in the space time. And this is the simplest model I could come up with, and it turned out that things work for this model. So the minimizers are they're broken lines, and the idea is to study the behavior of those minimizers over a long time interval. And I have to say that in principle, you can place. I mean, these points can come with random intensities as well, but the paper is written just for this. The other model that we can deal with is where the forcing is it's kick forcing. So it means that the forcing is applied only at integer discrete, or the way it's written is it's applied at integer times. And it means the following, that between integer times, the system follows the unforced Burgers equation. So these particles just travel around, they maybe bump into each other, something like that. But then at every integer time, you have a stationary process with fast decaying spatial dependence. And that and you alter the velocities of all the particles simultaneously with a kick using that adding that process everywhere. And right, and then they flow for time one freely without no forcing. And then there's another kick, they flow, kick, flow, and so on. And it turns out that the corresponding action now is discrete, so you have to work with minimizers of the following action. So the characteristics of this equation, so they are now broken lines like this. And it turns out that for both of these models, we can use the approach of that has roots in last passage preparation papers that are listed here. So we can use those tools to prove one force one solution principle for the Burgers equation with those two kinds of forcing. And so this is the main theorem. It says basically the same stuff. So for each v, there is a unique global solution with that average, with that spatial average. Now this solution is determined uniquely by the history of the forcing up to time. So this is the one force one solution principle, and it serves as a one point pullback attractor for a broad class of initial conditions. In particular, if you take an initial condition that averages on both sides to the same value v, and if you pull back that initial condition to minus infinity, then at any given time t you will recover this special global solution. And also it turns out that in space the solution is a stationary mixing process. Now of course that was the formulation in terms of the solutions of the equation itself, but it's all actually about the analysis of long minimizers of the action. And so the result on the previous slide, it is essentially a sophisticated corollary of the following statement. So in the case of Poissonian forcing, in both cases, you have these one-sided infinite minimizers, starting from every point in space-time and going back into the past with prescribed slope. Now, in the case of Poissonian forcing, moreover, these minimizers they all coalesce. So you start these two minimizers at different points, and then sooner or later they will find some Poisson point where they meet, and then they go together. And so this gives rise to the tree of those coalescing minimizers, and this is similar to the geodesic tree in first passage percolation models. Now, in the case of kick forcing, the situation is a little harder. So partially the motivation to study the kick forcing was that this picture looks like an oversimplification of the real thing, because due to the discrete nature of these Poissonian points, of course you have a simplified picture of these minimizers that allows you to define the Boosman functions easily, right? So here the Boosman function that compares the action of this infinite path to this infinite path is just the difference between these two actions, two finite actions, right? Because they share it, so that's easy. Now in the case of kick forcing that is smooth in space, there's no way that they can coalesce, really. So they can only, the best thing you can hope for is that they can come close together, right? So you hope for hyperbolicity. So you hope that they converge to each other exponentially fast. So I couldn't prove hyperbolicity, I could prove only a much weaker statement. instead of exponential thing here, exponential decay here, I have only power decay. And also this is a linear statement, so it means that these paths, they approach each other and maybe they diverge, and then they get closer and closer as time goes backward. But it turns out that this is enough, and so you can define all the the Boosman function along partial sequences of these times, and the entire ergodic program works. Now the techniques that I used, well, I told you that it's basic. I mean, to a large extent, these ideas originate in last passage, first passage, percolation papers, and the name of Chuck Newman. And many ideas originated from him. So one nice thing about these models is that the shape function is really nice for the Burgess equation. It turns out that it's precisely quadratic. So if you compute the optimal action between two points, so what is written here? Between time 0 and time t, you compute the action between 0 and point vt, right? So you take, this is 0, and this is time t, and this is point vt. And you compute the best action between those two points. It's a random variable, and the point of all this is to say that approximately this grows linearly, and this is due to some subadditivity, of course. And then you can so the linear growth is quantified by the shape function. So it grows linearly with various rates in different directions v, but the way this this looks, it's very nice, because it's good when this shape function is convex, and for this equation it can be precisely computed. This is the only thing that can be computed explicitly for this equation, for all this program, is the shape function, and it's precisely quadratic, and that's the best convex function you can hope for. And then you have these concentration inequalities for the action. How the distribution of the action concentrated near this linear growth. And with these estimates, you can prove things like straightness. So in particular, I mean, the previous equation gave you one estimate on characteristic exponent for this model. And this tells you that the fluctuation exponent is, well, it doesn't exceed 3/4, in fact. And so what's written here? So it turns out that it's really improbable to have this event where you have an optimal path that connects this point to the side of this parallelogram and goes through close to the middle. So probability of such an event is bounded by this. And so the largest delta you can take here is 1/4, and so. So this transversal thing can be at most t^3/4. So that's the bound on the fluctuation exponent. And such bounds, they are actually typical for several models of this sort. So this is a straightness estimate, and this replaces an estimate on the velocities, right? So in the compact setting, I told you that there is a very easy bound, uniform random bound on velocities of those minimizers. They cannot be too fast. And this is the analog of that. That can be used to prove existence of those minimizers, of infinite minimizers, right? So you take two points, and you take this point to plus infinity, and for each between that point and this fixed point, you construct a minimizer, and due to the straightness estimate, you can show that you cannot have this path that goes around a certain rectangle. Because that would violate straightness. And so it means that most of these minimizers, they will pass through such a rectangle. And then by doing this repeatedly and using the diagonal sequence, you can choose a converging sequence of finite time minimizers to an infinite minimizer. So This is what these minimizers might look like. So this is just a finite time picture that an undergraduate summer student did for me when I was at Georgia Tech. And so what's written here, what's drawn here is the initial condition was zero, and you have this field of Poissonian points, and for each point, the minimizer is drawn. Now, so you have here a part of that tree, except it's constructed in a finite box. Now, of course, different colors correspond to, I mean, so all these green points, they come from the same point here. One of the statements of the theorem is that in the infinite box, you will have just one color. And I have to mention that there's some work on geodesics and Busemann functions for lattice models, and this group also used geodesics and Busemann functions to construct stationary solutions of their lattice for their lattice models. Now ours is, I mean, first of all, they were doing this independently, and I think they didn't know about the work on the Bruges equation, the other Lagrangian flows. And ours is harder because we have essentially unbounded velocities and things are really non-compact. So, but there are certain results, of course, that they prove that we don't have. So now to the positive velocity case. Positive viscosity case. So the viscosity here is set to 1/2. Now in the compact case, the ergodic theory of such equation was constructed by these authors. In the non-compact case, there is a paper by Kiefer where he studies high dimensional situation with small forcing, and that corresponds to that's a weak disorder case. And weak disorder case is actually quite easier than the strong disorder case in this business. So what can we do? So recall that we do have a Feynman-Cass formula. So this is how we derive it. Just look here. So this is the Feynman-Cass formula. This Feynman-Cass formula defines an evolution operator from, you know, between any two times, right? Between time t0 and time t1. And if this v is a non-negative function, well, then you're integrating that with respect to this random positive kernel. And so this evolution is like is similar to the sequential products of positive random matrices. And so the result that you can hope for is something like the Perron-Frobenius theorem with complications that come from the non-compactness of this space and the randomness in time. But in the compact case, what Sinai did was essentially he obtained a version of the Perron-Frobenius theorem, and the papers by other people, including Kostya. So that was based on stochastic control. All right. So for this model, I also study kick force. Right. So I apply this kick transformation to the entire velocity field only at integer times. So between integer times, I just solve the unforced positive viscosity equation, and at integer time, I apply the kick force. So you can solve this kick force equation using the Hopf-Cole substitution. And if you want the corresponding evolution for this function v, that is the exponential of essentially exponential of u, then adding an additive kick corresponds to multiplicative kick for this v. And so you can see the Feynman-Cass evolution operator. I mean, for this model, you can write it down like this. So now this is a discrete version. So again, you're sort of integrating over Gaussian instead of the Brownian motion. You're integrating over discrete time random walk, and you also have random inputs from the potential. And this function that you see here, this kernel, it is actually the partition function of a polymer. That's how you can interpret it. And it's a natural way to deal with it. And so if you consider the corresponding polymer measure, right? So this is the partition function that I just defined. But you can also consider the corresponding. You can treat the Feynman-Katz formula as integration over all these paths. So you can treat that as integration over this polymer measure. So this is a caricature of those polymers. So using this, you obtain a random distribution on point-to-point paths. And you can ask, can you obtain something about the limiting behavior of this point-to-point distribution analogous to the situation with point-to-point minimizers, right? Point-to-point minimizers correspond to the zero temperature of this positive temperature model. And for point-to-point, point-to-point minimizers, we know that as I take this point to infinity along a direction, there will be a limiting trajectory. So now you can ask, if you take this point to infinity along a direction, v, if you consider a sequence of this polymer measure, will you have a limit? Hopefully yes. And this will be just the thermodynamic limit for these polymer measures. And surprisingly, nothing has been known, to the best of my knowledge. But we do, with my student, we do prove the thermodynamic limit of these Bruner's polymers. So yes, if you take this point to infinity, you get a unique limiting point. You have this random measure on infinite paths. That's the start, say, at fixed point 0, 0. But you can do this for any point here. Right. So this measure on infinite paths, it is concentrated on paths. I mean, with probability 1 according to that measure, all these paths have slope v. So it's sort of a strong law of large numbers holds. And that's what this theorem says. So there is a point-to-point limit of those polymer measures. But in fact, what we prove is that this limit is the same if you take not just point-to-point, but point-to-line and point-to-measure. Just you have this measure to satisfy the weak law of large numbers, and then the entire thing satisfies the strong law of large numbers, and the resulting measure is almost surely unique DLR measure for the Gaussian free measure and this random potential. Now technically this gets involved, so it say this is what the straightness statement looks like. Right, so there are two layers of randomness now. One is given by the environment, and the other is the polymer measure. And so what this says is, these red paths, they're very unlikely to happen according to this polymer measure, and the fact that the polymer measure assigns a not small weight to these red paths, that probability is very small. And so from this you can derive these statements that I mentioned in the previous slide. So the first result in this period in this direction was, to the best of my knowledge, obtained by Mejean, who proved concentration inequalities and fluctuation exponent has to estimate for actually very similar polymers. And notice that here also, delta is less than 1/4, so that means that the fluctuation exponent is no more than 3/4. This is the estimate. I mean, if we believe in the KPZ universality, then of course it's supposed to be 2/3. three quarters as several models like this will give you. And in fact, from these polymer measures, you can read off the solution of the Burgers equation. So you can use these, you can use the family of those polymer measures, right? So, okay, I showed you that for each binding point, there is a polymer measure that was growing upwards on the previous slide. So now I rotate the picture, and so this polymer measure goes downwards, the time goes up. But the point is that it turns out that all these measures, they are consistent with each other. And so together they define a velocity field of the Burgers equation. That gives you a global solution of the Burgers equation. And that solution also satisfies the one-force-one solution principle. You can start with a variety of initial conditions and pull them back to minus infinity, and still you will recover the global solution that is given by this picture. So namely, the velocity here is just the integral of x minus y, where y is the distribution of y is the marginal distribution of the polymer measure. So again, this group of researchers has some results in this direction. So they prove the thermodynamic limit for log gamma polymer. And that's due to the fact that the things are very explicit for the log gamma. You can really compute stuff, and we have to suffer through all these straightness estimates. And also they have some results of Busemann functions for polymers, for lattice polymers, and these results are conditional. So if something is satisfied, then you can derive results on ratios of partition functions. And these results, as far as I understand, they apply only to the weak disorder case. And what we are dealing here in 1D with the Burgers equation, so that's a strong disorder. And so again, it looks like our situation here is more, is harder due to for a couple of reasons. Okay, so I should stop here. I'll just flash a slide with various unsolved problems of all kinds that are strongly related to what I have talked about, or maybe more vaguely. Progress in any of these will be nice. So I'll stop here. Thank you. Well, if your process, if the potential is space stationary, then the system is in distribution. It is invariant under space-time shears. It's Galilean invariance. So you really apply this. You let all these particles move with additional velocity v, and then you just recompute the action, and you get a deterministic increment of the action that precisely equals to v squared over 2.
In the positive temperature version, do you also have the
exactly same thing? I mean, you have
what the limit shape is.
Yes. So you have to. So instead of the action, that corresponds, of course, to the free energy, which is the limit of 1 over n times logarithm of z. And that's exactly if you take the minus sign in front of this, then it will be exactly quadratic, just as in the zero temperature, zero viscosity case, for the same reason.
This family of infinite measures, polymer measures connected, whenever you choose a direction, then you are able to construct an infinite thermodynamic limit in some sense. Do they relate in the sense of large deviations? I mean, if I take one which is heading in direction psi, that I condition to be near n xi prime at sometime n. Is it that?
I don't know.
What question is whether you can get in the shift or?
If I take one of these measures, I condition by an unlikely behavior to go not in the direction of xi, but at a certain time to be close to n xi prime difference on xi. Should I locally
but this, get I think you what you get is really just means that you're conditioning the endpoint of your polymer to be not here, but there. So this means that you're systematically just reconstructing the other.
You mean it's already written in the DLR function?
Yes. Yes. So you will just reconstruct the other DLR measure in the wrong direction.
Here again.